And we're recognizing that there was a place for a kind of design in the digital sphere that didn't exist in books and magazines and static publications, that was more of a systemic approach to design.
These are originally live chat sessions that I held, and you can join them in the future every Tuesdays at 5 p.m. PST on cells.n.pixels on Instagram. My name is Koji, and this is Cells and Pixels. All right, so my guest today is Jesse James Garrett. If you're in Wexfield, you heard of him before, for sure. He's the author of the classic book Elements of User Experience. But beyond that, Jesse James also came up with the concept of Ajax, basically that shape modern dynamic web. And also he founded Adaptive Path, which is one of the most important and probably the first UX consultancy around. Recently, he also started a podcast named Finding Your Our Way with Adaptive Path founder Peter Mirvoltz. I was learning more about you in your podcast that you started with hobbying. And I know like a lot of people started with hobbying, you know, when they think about design or think about technology in general. I would like to hear a little bit more how you started creating websites, blogging, to be one of the founders of what we know today as UX.
Yeah. Well, I was, thank you for having me. This is super fun. I was a writer and I was a writer right around the time that the internet was springing into commercial viability in the mid-90s. And I was looking, I'd always been interested in technology, but had not really thought of myself as a technical person. I like working with technology, but I'm really more of a creative type. And I got very interested in the challenges of writing for this new medium and the ways in which the way we use language, the way we use content might need to evolve as we were moving out of the linear forms of paper publications, books and magazines and things like that toward these things that we were creating that are more dynamic, more living, more complex and diverse and multifaceted and multidimensional. And it was in exploring that that I started getting interested in design issues. And blogging for me was a way to discover what the intersection between content and form was going to look like on the web. So I had the day job where I was writing for websites, but then on the side, I was creating this blog, which at the time, the blogs were not a thing. We did not have a name for these things. It was my friend Peter Mirvoltz who actually came up with the word blog to describe it, that he and I had been both part of that sort of scene in the late 90s. And I believe it's really valuable to have side projects that allow us to ask questions we don't get to ask at work and to chase down ideas that might not, you know, be the most commercially viable ideas, but can enrich and inform our creative work. So it was actually through the blogging work that I met Peter, blogging as a hobby, that I met Peter, and we got to talking about our mutual interests, and that is ultimately how we came to start Adaptive Path, as we had both been working in this emerging area of digital design. And we're recognizing that there was a place for a kind of design in the digital sphere that didn't exist in books and magazines and static publications, that was more of a systemic approach to design. And that was something that would require paying a lot more attention to people's behavior. You know, when I was working, you know, doing more traditional kind of content work, you put the content together, you slap it between a couple of covers, you ship it, and then what people do with it doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter a lot. But when you're dealing with a website, which is a living entity, it actually matters a lot how people use it, because how people use it is going to determine whether it continues to be a living entity or whether it's going to dry up and die. And so Peter and I were both really interested in those problems and saw an opportunity in the early 2000s as the crop of web design shops that existed at the time were very heavily influenced by traditional graphic design and marketing practices. We saw an opportunity to bring a different lens, to bring a different mindset and a different approach to the work. And so we started our company Adaptive Path. We chose the word, the term user experience to describe the work that we did at a time when other people were not using that kind of language at all. And
we said that was like web design, or that was it.
Yeah. We were competing against web design firms, and there were some larger consultancies that were doing what they called digital transformation work at the time, which is helping companies build out, you know, all of these shiny new systems that they would need to build. And so user experience as a distinct standalone offering for a consultancy was a brand new thing that we did out there in the world. Thankfully, a lot of other people followed suit.
Very cool. I'm pretty sure like a lot of people who follow me, you know, kind of like build their careers upon the things that you started. So we appreciate that. Okay. So you originally, let's talk about your book, and I want to try something new here. Let's see if this works, but I want to bring your book to the screen because I want to make sure that people visualize what the book is. And this cover to me is classic. Like, you don't even need to read anything. You just look at the cover, you know what the book is. So you originally published this book in 2002, and it's been 18 years. It's crazy. You know, what have changed and what haven't changed in UX field, in your opinion? And maybe to give a little bit more of like food for thought here, do you have any plans for a new version?
Just a little bit of background about the book. This book started out as just a single sheet of paper, a one-page diagram that I created in 2000. And it became one of the earliest sort of staples of cubicle art for designers around that time. It was something that you started to see around a lot on a lot of people's walls. And the publisher approached me about turning it into a book. And I was interested in writing a book, but I was not interested in writing the same book over and over again. I really tried with the first edition of the book in 2002 to, as much as possible, capture the things that I did not think were going to change very much about the work that we did. And the book came out, was a lot of people really responded well to it. It's a very short book, uses very simple language. I designed it to be a book that designers could give to executives to help them speak the same language. And it turned out that simplifying things to the point where an executive can follow it also makes something a great resource for a beginner in the field. And that was when the book started really getting a lot of traction as a teaching tool, and found a lot of people using it in their courses and things like that. So the book got to be more popular, and the publisher came around and asked me about doing a second edition of the book, which I agreed to, and went ahead and did in 2010. And what I found with doing the second edition of the book was that there were actually a bunch of things that I thought were going to be eternal universals in 2002 that turned out not to be. And it was a bit of a disappointment to the publisher that when I delivered the second edition of the book, they wanted to promote it as being expanded enhanced. And I had to break it to them that in fact the new edition was 16 pages shorter than the old edition, as I've found a bunch of things to cut out that I didn't need to explain anymore because they were very particular to the technological landscape in that moment, or they were areas of ambiguity that didn't really exist anymore for the field. And that the 2010 version of the book is now 10 years old, which is still plenty old for a technology book. And that one seems to have held on. I haven't read the book in a long time. I'm sure there are folks who would take issue with, how up to date some of the ideas in it are, but I continue to hear from people all the time who use it regularly as a teaching tool and as a way of introducing these ideas to new people. So I'm really gratified by that. And the other thing that's happened is that, at the time that I published it, there were no books on user experience. There were no other resources. I mean, there were books that were related to user experience. You could get a book on interaction design. You could get a book on information architecture. And now there's just so much. You can fill libraries with the knowledge that's out there. So I'm grateful that I don't have to be the only one to carry the burden of educating folks.
Very cool. And I want to talk about one specific part of the book, because this is another piece of classic information for UX, the elements of user experience. Do you think that's also changed, or do you think like this is still pretty much the same, that high level idea of the elements?
Yeah, I think there is something about the structure of the diagram that speaks to something really universal, in that you're always going to have that continuum from abstract to concrete. You are always going to have the broader considerations that are going to be driving ever and ever more narrow considerations. Those things are going to be universal about design. And in fact, I've heard from a number of people who have come across the book and have used this as a framework for other kinds of creative work that have nothing to do with product design. That that they have talked about it in terms of creating other kinds of things for people and just following that same kind of cascade of effects from the abstract to the concrete, from the strategic through the structural to the surface level details, turns out to be really kind of a universal pattern for a lot of creative work. Then when you get into the details, when you get past the five planes and you start like taking apart, well, what's exactly inside those? That's when it starts to be a really different story. I originally created this in the context of web design. A lot of people have used it for the design of a broader range of kinds of digital products and for service design as well, to look at how product ecosystems fit together and those kinds of things. So people have been able to take the model and extend it in whatever direction serves them. And so I think that in a lot of ways, it's kind of not for me to say how applicable the model still is, as long as I keep hearing from people who are using it, making good use of it and getting good value out of it. I think it's going to stay alive for as long as people want it.
Yeah. To me, the structure that you built here, I think it really helped me to figure out the way where I could communicate and structure my thinking to a broader team. Because I think before that, like if you think about graphic design was very focused on the visuals, and not much in the process itself. So it was really hard to like explain and also like make people participate in the design process. I think this was like very special and unique at that time.
Yeah, I think that you touch on something really important, which is inviting participation. And again, thinking about that, the culture of graphic design that dominated at the time that I first did this work. In the culture of graphic design, you have the single creative genius visionary who often is, you know, working alone, slaving over the fine details of some artifact. And there's not a lot of room. There's not a lot of invitation for other people to be a part of that process. And one of the challenges that graphic designers faced in the transition to the web was the need to be more inclusive, the need to do a lot more listening, and the need for that creative process to turn into more of a dialogue. And so I'm happy to hear you talk about using it as a communications tool, because that's what I originally created it for. My intent was for this to be a way for people to find a shared vocabulary, find a common language, find common ground for those collaborative conversations that were not happening enough in design at that time, and frankly, still, I think, don't happen as much as they should.
Right. Cool. And we talked a little bit about Adaptive Path. Adaptive Path was a groundbreaking and pioneer UX consultancy, and probably the first one. Many of UX consultancies were acquired by large companies. And I listened to your first podcast episode where you're having this discussion on, you know, how your role evolved. But I'm curious about, do you feel like 2020, like there's space for UX consultancies, or do you feel like one model kind of like worked better than the other, or do you feel like there's space for the in-house, but also the consult?
Yeah, it's been an interesting evolution, because when we started doing this work, there was nobody in-house who had even heard of the work. So we had to do a lot of selling and a lot of education in order to build the market for our services. And that went so well that a lot of companies decided that they needed to have those competencies in-house. And then we saw the rise of in-house UX teams. And for a while, there was still a place for us as consultants. And I'm not just talking about Adaptive Path, I'm talking about UX consultants in general. Because we still had all of the knowledge, we still had all of the deeper experience that an in-house team was going to be slow to acquire. But in-house teams started getting really good. They started getting more sophisticated about their processes. They started getting more sophisticated about the competencies that they hired into their organizations. And they started getting aggressive about claiming their territory and really owning it. And as a result, for UX consultancies, frequently the conversation shifted from the other consultancies that we were competing against to how do we compete again effectively against our own customers, against their internal capabilities? What do you do when you're engaged on one side of a turf war inside the organization over who truly speaks for the customer, who truly has ownership of the design, those kinds of things? It created a whole new set of challenges for us as consultants. And I think that for a lot of the consultancies that existed at that time, so Adaptive Path was acquired by the US Bank Capital One in 2014, as part of there was a whole wave of consultancies of most of them I felt like were at a kind of a smaller scale, similar to ours. Our company was not a very large company. Yeah. Yeah.
I worked with the guys from Kubo Council at Google. So I remember when they had like a wave of acquiring for agencies and consultancies.
Yeah. So the in-house teams got kind of built up their competencies to a critical point, started to realize that this was going to be an essential competitive advantage for them. And based on that, these companies saw these strategic investment in these, as you put it, these acqui-hire investments as a way to rapidly advance their skills. Now, there's a whole cultural dimension to acquiring a design team that I think a lot of these organizations did not take into account. And I have heard about some of the difficulties of design teams that have been challenged by integrating into Google, integrating into Facebook, integrating into these large organizations, and feeling like they were more just sort of like vacuumed up into them. And I feel fortunate that we had the opportunity with Capital One to take a more active role in shaping what the culture was going to look like on an ongoing basis. The folks there really wanted, they wanted some of our magic, and they wanted to be able to scale that up from 50 people to 500 people. And they were willing to listen. And that was just a really great experience. Not to say that there weren't enormous challenges with it, because it's a giant, giant company and a huge complex range of different design problems that they're trying to address. But we did not get vacuumed up like those other organizations did. And so where we are right now with UX consultancies, I think, is those mid-sized consultancies that were trying to replace your in-house team to provide kind of the full suite of services of an in-house team are having a hard go of things, I think, because the in-house teams have gotten a lot better at their jobs, and they have different in-house teams have developed different core competencies, different core strengths. And so for the UX consultancy these days, I feel like it's not a matter of can you bring a full suite of UX capabilities, but can you bring the set of UX capabilities that you know a segment of your market is missing? So the production level UX work often is the stuff that the organizations have been more successful at integrating in-house. And the strategy and research work is the stuff that they, from my vantage point, has been harder for businesses to bring in-house and tends to be the kind of thing that they look to a consultancy for. The other value that a consultancy brings that I think is not going to go away is sometimes an organization just needs an outside perspective. They need somebody who is not inside their bubble, who is not inside their echo chamber, who is not reading the same things, hearing the same things, you know, processing the same inputs as you are all the time, but somebody who can come at your problem from a different vantage point and offer an alternative perspective that's informed by different background, that's informed by different inputs, informed by different experiences.
I love what you said, because I feel a lot of the companies that I join, a lot of teams that I join, they have those like first weeks where they say, we really want to listen to your feedback right now, because we know like after a few months or so, you're like into the weeds. And then I think there's this narratives that we buy once we start to be part of the team. And whereas we are like an outsider, you really don't have anything, like, you know, you don't have anything, you don't own anything to anyone.
Yeah. And that goes both ways, because I have talked to a lot of people about whether they should join a consultancy or whether they should join an in-house team. And some people, they join the consultancy for a while and they're happy with the variety, but then they get frustrated about not being able to carry a problem through multiple iterations, not having the opportunity to do that second research study where you get to dive deeper with the customers and find out, you know, deeper layers of what's going on, not having the opportunity to build out that more robust model of customer behavior to be able to drive the design work and so forth. And so in-house, you do have the opportunity to really take ownership, take stewardship of a product, take stewardship of a design, and it can be your baby for a while in a way that at the end of the day, the consultants are not really going to ever be more than babysitters.
Makes sense. And there is a phrase that you mentioned during your podcast about your experience at Capital One, which I thought was fascinating. You said the way that the design team works together and interacts influences the design outcomes, especially when you think about like an in-house design team. How do you compare this for you, for your personal experience being an adaptive path versus being in in-house design team at Capital One? How was the difference for you in terms of how do you grow your team? How do you think about the design leaders that you manage in that organization?
Yeah. So the shift from adaptive path to Capital One was a challenging one, because the drivers are different for how design decisions or strategic design decisions get made. As we were making this transition, as we were looking at how to scale our culture from 50 people to 500, I got really interested in the problem of team resilience. Because what I would see would be teams would come together, they would push through, do some work, deliver something great, and then everybody would be off to the next opportunity. The knowledge got lost, the wisdom got lost. And then a new team would be assembled to carry that work forward, but there was no continuity, and in a lot of ways they were starting over. And that was one type of team. But then I saw another type of team that would be able to stay together, and like all of the stakeholders' requirements would change and they could adapt. And, you know, the competitor would come out with an offering that was very similar to ours and they would adapt, and creating more, ironically, adaptive path, right? Creating more adaptive teams actually really kind of became an important part of the work that I was doing at Capital One. And that was where I came to realize that trust and safety within teams is the critical factor. That a team where people don't feel safe with one another, if they don't feel supported by one another, if they don't feel heard and seen by one another, is a team where people are less likely to take chances, less likely to throw out that crazy idea that just might work, less willing to negotiate, and less able to stick together and hold the course when their project is upended by change. So for me, that connection between team dynamics and outcomes is really very powerful. You can do all of the, you can nail the research and you can nail your design process and you can have all of the stakeholders doing the right thing every step of the way. And if the team at the heart of all of it is in friction, all of it is at risk.
Awesome. I love that. And it's interesting because as a Brazilian myself, I moved to US 6 years ago. And I think we always talk about like how inclusive teams and diverse teams are more powerful and can build better products, right? Like, but if there is no safety, it's really hard to have someone who maybe just joined your company who is like a have English as a second language, or maybe it's part of a minority that doesn't feel very comfortable to really challenge your opinions and your decisions, right? So it's it's a very interesting topic. I love that. And I'm really happy that you're talking about that in your podcast too.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's so important. I mean, obviously, you know, we talk about the how diversity improves the quality of design, being able to draw on different perspectives, being able to draw on people who bring a different range of life experiences to the table. It allows us to see things that we wouldn't otherwise see and to imagine possibilities that we might not otherwise be able to imagine. So the connection between having diverse voices in the room and creating space for those voices and the outcomes that you create is really strong there. But then it comes back to the leader and the leader in the room, the tone that that leader sets, and the little moment-to-moment decisions that they make that tell somebody whether or not their voice is welcome in the room. And they can be really small, subtle things in the way that a leader draws voices into the discussion, the way that a leader chooses to amplify different voices in a discussion. Those kinds of choices are the choices that contribute toward setting a tone that creates that sense of safety, creates that sense of trust. It's everybody's job. Don't get me wrong. It is definitely not just on the leader to create safety, but it is on the leader to model and to establish a tone and to hold that tone and to demonstrate the behaviors that they want to encourage and the behaviors that are not welcome. And to continue to do that on an ongoing basis. And so the work that I'm doing now, I left Capital One at the end of last year. And the work that I'm doing now is as an independent leadership coach, I'm working directly with design leaders, helping them untangle these issues of team dynamics, of creating a sense of safety and trust on their teams, and creating a sense of inclusion to create create more belonging, really.
Awesome. Great. And I definitely want to share your contacts because I know a lot of people will be interested on that. So let's do it on the end of the conversation. Yes. I want to talk a little bit about leadership more. You have this phrase, I don't know, I think it was your website, leadership is just another design problem. And to me, that was fascinating because to me, at some point in my career, it was like, I want to nail down how to design a great product from zero to one. Then I worked at Google for a couple of years, 9 years, and then I built a product. I failed multiple times. Then I built a product that I thought was, okay, this is successful. I'm good to go. And then for me now, the biggest challenge is how do I solve the problem with human relationships in organizations. So I saw this phrase in your website and was intrigued. And I want to hear a little bit more about your thoughts around that.
Yeah, well, I have worked with a lot of people who are new to design leadership, and they have told me a very similar story to yours, which is that as designers, they felt really grounded in their craft, and they felt really grounded in the value that they created. It was very clear to them. And then they were so good at that job that they were elevated to a leadership role and then found themselves not being able to apply most of the skills that got them there because they had this new set of responsibilities that revolved around something very different. And for a lot of designers who feel like their strength is really in their craft skills, it can be challenging to figure out, well, who am I now as a leader? And what am I doing here? And in working with these leaders, what I've come to realize is that design has a lot less to do with the medium that you're working within or the outcome that you're trying to create. And it has a lot more to do with the mindset and the philosophy that you bring to the work. And so when I say that that leadership is just another design problem, what I mean is that if you take a step back from leadership and look at what it actually is, you can apply a lot of the tools of design to solving leadership problems. Have you done your discovery? Have you done some ideation? Have you done some prototyping? Have you, you know, gathered your metrics to show you what's working and what isn't? And for a lot of people, the shift is really just in understanding that you're working in a different medium now than you used to be. You used to be dealing with pixels or code or flows or other kinds of things. And one thing that I say on the podcast sometimes is leadership is relationship. The work of leadership is the work of relationship. It is the work of relationship building, relationship cultivation. And if you think of relationships as being not just things that sort of happen to us, but things that we get the chance to actively and intentionally design and create for ourselves, there's an opportunity there to use that designer mindset and that that in a lot of ways that that conceptual ideation skill set to support creating healthier, more robust relationships.
Makes sense. Cool. Okay, I want to pause here because I have something that I want to show you. This is the album. What is the name of the album again? Hallelujah, Don't Bend, Ascend.
Don't Bend, Ascend.
Yes. Is it the latest? I don't know anymore if there's a new one. But it was the last one that I got from Godspeed You Black Emperor, which is one of my favorite bands too. I've seen them live here in SF. I want to talk about music with you very quickly. Looks like you're a big fan of post-rock, and
yeah.
Your Twitter cover is a Godspeed Your Black Emperor cover. And I remember in your book, you mentioned other bands like Mogwai, Tortoise, among others. What excites you about post-rock? Do you see any relationship on your work ethics or in your way you work? Your approach to work?
I really started digging into post-rock when I was writing the book. I was looking for music that I could work to that did not have words. And I got bored with electronica. There was something about the repetitive rhythm of it, which works so wonderfully for so many people. I know so many people who they just get the headphones on and it's electronica all day long. And I was looking for something else, and I happened to walk into a record store in San Francisco, which sadly is recently closed down, called Aquarius Records, which is one of San Francisco's wonderful, strange, obscure record stores in the Mission, actually. And I was just kind of browsing around there and stumbled across this whole category. And took some home, and it was exactly what I needed in terms of being guitar and drum driven music that was more kind of textural and less about kind of pop songs. So I find it really enhances my concentration. To listen to that music. Explosions in the Sky is another band that I saw both Explosions in the Sky and Godspeed within the last year or so, and those are wonderful experiences. I highly recommend listen to music while you work. I saw somebody on Twitter the other day said that they had seen the, so I put in the front of the book, I put a list of all the music that I listened to while I was writing the book. And somebody had actually taken up the idea to create a Spotify playlist of some of the musicians that I referenced at the beginning of the book. So he's reading the book while listening to the music that I was listening to while I was writing the book. So that's fun.
Beautiful. Yeah, the human impact is huge for sure. And I want to go back to Adaptive Path very quickly, because connecting to your experience with the book, and I think looking at Adaptive Path and looking at how other UX consultancies or design consultancies played a role in the industry, I think what I really liked about Adaptive Path is that you had this very clear, strong educational arm with the UX Week, and also kind of like the mission itself was to kind of like make UX a broader discussion in the industry. Like, how much do you feel we still have to like evolve in that discussion in terms of UX education, especially when we talk about cross-functional peers? With my experience working with big companies, I still feel like maybe there are some areas to improve, like, but I would love to hear your opinion.
And thank you. The educational work was always really important to us. Our goal was to advance the field by whatever means were available to us. And if that meant doing consulting work, if that meant doing pro bono work, if that meant doing the educational work, whatever it was. But the educational work also required us to have a point of view about the right way to do things, and not just make it up one way one time and make it up a different way another time, but actually to think through what we felt was most important and what we really cared about. Where we are right now is it's so huge. I don't even know if you could estimate the size of the field of UX right now. I mean, I would guess that in terms of the number of UX professionals worldwide, it is several hundred thousand, you know, maybe in the millions, of UX people. Can you imagine?
And I think we're probably in the millions.
Yeah. It's amazing to think about. And each of those people has found their way to it through their own path. And there are not consistent ways for people to find their way into the field yet, which means that each of us comes to the work with our own unique set of experiences that has brought us to this place. So what you see is a really wide variation in sophistication. You see a really wide variation in the breadth of knowledge that somebody has. I know, you know, some people who have done, like, put in decade plus long careers in UX that have been so narrowly focused that if you took them outside of that context, I'm not sure that they would even be able to show up as a UXer, you know? So there is a lot of work to do, I think, and there is a lot of the educational work, to your point, with cross-functional teams, the educational work with our partners, with product managers and technology partners especially, I think, is the evangelism needs to continue. What perhaps it needs at this point is a dose more humility than it has had in the past, because we definitely came charging in the early 2000s, like, we're UX, we're going to solve all your problems for you. And don't listen to anybody else, they're all wrong. And that got a lot of attention and made a lot of headway for the field for a while. But we're in a place now where the work requires us to be more humble and to see ourselves as participants and peers and not authors and owners of these processes.
Love that. Awesome. Okay, the conversation's been amazing. I think I learned a lot talking with you here for just these minutes. I want to give you some space to share like your website or whatever project you're working on. Really like your space to talk about anything before we wrap up. But yeah, thank you, Jesse.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been fun. I always love talking about this stuff. As I mentioned, I'm now an independent leadership coach. I work directly one-on-one with design leaders to help them be stronger leaders and create stronger teams. I am especially helping people out with clarity and intentionality in their work as leaders to be more explicit, to be more focused, and to stay present with what really matters to them. And if you don't know what that is, we can help you find that out. So if you want to know more about my coaching practice, you can find information about that at jessejamesgarrett.com.
Awesome. jessejamesgarrett.com. Again, thanks a lot for your time, Jesse.
Thank you so much. This has been fun.
My name is Koji, and this is Cells and Pixels. Every Tuesdays at 5 p.m. PST on cells.n.pixels on Instagram. Thanks for listening.